Amanda L. Goodman, and I'm guest hosting Circulating Ideas for Steve Thomas this week. Today, I'll be talking with Frank Scornia about virtual reality at his public library.
Hi.
Hey, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, thank you. This is going to be a lot of fun, I think.
So first off, how did you become a librarian? What is your origin story?
Okay, well, it started off when I was really young, and I was walking along the beach one day, and there was this dark cave that showed up. So I, being a curious sort of person, I kind of went my way in, and I fell down a hole. And as I was falling down the hole, it was surrounded by books all around. And then I hit the bottom, and no. Actually, what happened was is I left college with a history degree and not much of job prospects, looked around for a while, and then went back to library school with the intent to kind of get a degree because I was interested in research and digital archives and just something that my history degree, I was burned out with writing, and I just wanted to do something, get off the job market for a little bit. So after library school, I worked at a nonprofit organization working with families of 9/11 victims, doing digital archive work. That moved to, I went to a TV network working in their media resources archives. So if you ever watch like a documentary program on the History Channel and they show archival footage, I was one of the people that dug that archival footage out of our archives. And then I got hired at the Ferguson Library in Stamford, Connecticut. And that's my origin, pretty much.
Was that a big change going from, like, behind the scenes to going more public-facing?
It was. Prior to working in libraries, I worked as a retail associate, so I was used to the customer service and public-facing side. But yeah, it was a big shift. When I was originally in school, my intentions never really were to work in a public library. I was going to focus academic library, doing reference and instruction work. So this was a path that was never really conceived before. It's been nice. It's been a really interesting and exciting kind of job and area to work in.
So what is your title at Ferguson Library?
So I'm the digital librarian for information and adult services.
Wow.
Yeah, it's fancy, isn't it? Which basically boils down to I manage and work with our electronic resources and digital media, so our ebooks, our databases. I schedule and teach our technology classes, focusing a lot more on kind of the higher technology kind of things, so more advanced Word, Excel, Microsoft Office type stuff, website development. I'm doing a class in video editing in a couple months. And then I also provide training for our staff in new digital technologies that we're offering, such as our VR lab or our makerspace technologies. In addition to all of that there, I do have reference and collection development duties as well.
Wow, you're a little bit everywhere in the library.
Yeah, I wear many hats. I also work with our digital archives, too.
Oh, wow.
So I brought that along with me.
So the first time I heard about Ferguson Library's VR system was actually one of my patrons. It should be noted that Frank and I work maybe 5-6 miles apart from each other. So this patron comes up to me and she's like, "Oh, you need to go to Ferguson Library. Did you know that on Saturdays they have like a system that you can try out? It's so much better than what you got." And I was like, "What?" And so I messaged Frank and I was like, "What is going on over there?" And you gave me that personal invitation to come over and look at your system. It took me about 6 months before I finally got myself together on a Saturday to go.
I think when you got there, I was teaching a class, so I didn't get to see you.
Yes. And I was just wandering around the building till I found it. I was not a believer in virtual reality stuff. You know, I'd played with Google Cardboard. We had done that for a few years at my library. But within like 2 minutes of putting on that headset, like, completely changed my mind. And when my husband did it, he loved it so much that he convinced his own library to get it. So they would like to thank you, though I'm not sure his library knows that's where you got the idea from. So tell me, like, how did your library decide to acquire a VR system?
Okay, so like you did, we started off with experimenting with like the Google Cardboard. It was kind of a natural extension of what we had been doing in our makerspace already. I mean, with the makerspace, we had our 3D printer, and we had the Arduinos, and we were doing the Raspberry Pis and all of that there. And VR started really kind of catching the interest, and it just seemed kind of a good extension there. So we bought several of the decent Google Cardboard headsets. We'd hold demos. We'd bring it to public events that we had like displays at, have it as part of our makerspace activities to kind of encourage people to come in and see the other things that we're going to do. But the real kind of like tipping point came is that we have a local entrepreneur who works in management training. And he's his big focus lately has been on virtual reality as a training medium for managers, so they get put into certain situations and being able to deal with situations in a virtual experience that might be more lifelike than just like simulating or role playing can do.
Mm-hmm.
So he's the one who bought the original systems. And the problem was, is he was working out of like a shared workspace in Stanford at the time, and he didn't really have a place to put it. And he also he wasn't thrilled by the idea of spending $3,000 to $4,000 on equipment and it sitting in a closet for 80% of the time. So his idea was, hey, the library is a safe, secure space. They have places that we can kind of lock and secure. I can have it there, and at the same time, we can make it available to the public. So in kind of return for us kind of storing his equipment for him, we would be allowed to open it up to the public to try out responsibly. So it became a resource for the public to access expensive and new technology. Belief around like 3D printers. Why do libraries have 3D printers? It's because they're expensive and people think that they're really cool, but they don't want to buy them themselves. So here, we can give you access to that. They're the same thing with virtual reality. There's a lot there. It's a complex system. It can be daunting for a new person to come in. But if you have a place that you can go that's comfortable, that can help guide you through, be a tour guide into VR, it allows people to introduce the VR technology a lot better. So the entrepreneur, he was also busy trying to organize other VR events around Connecticut. He would do things in Fairfield County and New Haven County. He would do VR hackathons. And what would happen is he would come and take his equipment and bring it to like a space in New Haven that's having the VR hackathon. And sometimes it wouldn't come back in a timely fashion, or it just wouldn't come back when we would need it because we would have planned programming. And so it started to become less dependable when we can do programming on there. So we made the decision eventually to just buy our own system to be able to have more reliable programming in that regards.
So when did you get that original borrowed system? When was that brought to your library?
Okay, let's see. Probably October or November of 2016.
Okay, so fairly recently.
Yeah. And then we bought our own probably around May of 2017.
Okay. Was it two different systems or?
No, we went with what we had before, which was the HTC Vive, which at that point, and it still is kind of one of the peak kind of headset systems on the market right now. It's also one of the room scale systems, which basically means that you're able to set up a space that the person wearing the headset can actually walk around in. So they're not fixed to a single point or having to react to static virtual simulations. They can actually interact with a lot larger space.
I'm trying to remember, how was it set up? Like the sensors, are they on the ceiling or are they on stands?
Trying to think if when you were there, they may have been on stands. We've mounted them on the wall now. We actually had our facility people go in and put in the mounting brackets. So the mounting brackets are actually, I think even the sensors, we actually have them kind of permanently out, kind of visible. We do take the power connect because whenever they're plugged in, they're powered up. So we actually, when we're taking down the system, we just unplug them and put the power cables away. So they are physically mounted in our wall. We have a room that was initially provided by the Rotary Club of Sanford, the ones who provide the funding, and the intent was on literacy. And so we've kind of stretched that definition a little bit to including like digital literacy. We used to have like our foreign language, like our Ellis computers in there. But now we kind of it's our VR kind of digital literacy kind of room in some ways. But it can be closed. We have a cabinet that we lock away our other equipment, but it allows kind of a good secure spot to have this equipment set up and for people to explore it.
So what is your particular role with it?
So day to day, I don't run it so much. Our makerspace librarian handles a lot of that. I am still on hand for training and running. If our makerspace librarian isn't available, I'm the person called up to set it up and run demos and talk about it. In addition, I try to bring in any of our other digital initiatives or efforts to include VR aspects if we can, or how to include it. So on a day-to-day, I don't do much with it, but I am there as an expert in the system and able to provide support for either our staff using it or for our other librarians, or if we have guests coming in to use it or to run any events or programming that we do.
And what has the public's reaction been to it?
It's been interesting. It has that same kind of like awe. People are hearing about virtual reality now. Virtual reality is out there in the news. People hear it. They hear the stories about it. And so the idea that, hey, you can come in and try it, and the fact that we're a library and we don't charge, there's even that kind of perk. So it's been really big, people coming in. We initially started off our programming. We would do free play events, which is what you came for. The idea that for a few hours in the afternoon, usually Saturday afternoons, it was available for anybody to show up, first come, first serve, to spend 10, 15, 20 minutes kind of exploring that there. And we'd see kind of a shifting attendance to that there. At the beginning, we get a whole bunch of people, and then it kind of tapered off a lot. Occasionally, we'll get 2 to 3 people showing up, and they'll spend a good amount of time with that there. So it's almost like we've kind of reached the saturation point of the people who know about it and want to try something new. So yeah, that's kind of what the reaction is. I mean, people are excited. If we have it out in a space that that's more open, that people are wondering by and see it, there's that still that kind of like gasp and kind of like, oh, what is this here? An explanation, can I try out kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But as our kind of normal free play events are, they've kind of like died down and kind of seem to be kind of blasé at this point.
So I also – so besides that word of mouth marketing from mm-hmm. our joint patron – I subscribed to your library's newsletter, and then I started seeing it in there. What other marketing venues are you aware of?
I mean, we try to reach out to the tech community in Stanford a bit. We are – a little kind of plug coming up is next weekend. We are doing the – we're hosting the International Game Jam for Fairfield County at our library. And I'm really hoping that that the equipment's available there, that one of the teams may want to do something with virtual reality. Because that was one of the original kind of intents with it, was to make it also available for developers. Because, again, it's expensive software, and if anybody wanted to experiment with developing for VR, the place that they could come and have equipment that they could try what they're working on out. So what other kind of market? So we've tried to go with the tech community in some ways. Word of mouth mainly in our normal marketing channels. We really haven't reached out other ways. I mean, we've had one of the local online newspapers come and do a story. I'm not certain if the major local newspaper, The Advocate, has done anything. They might have. I think at the beginning we may have had them come in, and they've come in for some of like the bigger events that we've done.
Do you have an idea of the cost range for this equipment?
So the headsets, and there's a variety of the headsets out there right now. The top that we have right now is the Vive. The pricing on that when we got it, it was about 800. I think there was a price drop this year. I think it might be around 600 or so now. That's the headset. And in addition to having the headset, which that comes with the headset, controllers, and your satellite stations, your sensor stations. But you need to have a computer that can handle the kind of graphical power that VR needs. So kind of your normal kind of off-the-shelf computer typically doesn't have enough power for that kind of thing. We bought a gaming laptop that cost us, I'm going to say, about $1,600. So all in all, we spent about $2,400 for this setup.
How about the games and other activities?
Okay, so there are there's a lot of free experiences out there. So there are some that we've purchased. We have an account set up on Steam, which is where the PC gaming store, online gaming store, where a lot of the Vive's software lives. But mostly we've been kind of exploring a lot of the free options that are out there. So things like demos, because the demos tend to be really good for how we do our programming with the with kind of the free play and the exploration, because they have their own built-in limited time. It gives people a good taste of a lot of different experiences. So the free demos there tend to work really well. Some things that have stood out, I'm trying to remember, there are a couple that we've bought, but most things kind of run in around $10 to $15 that we buy, so it's not a huge outlay. But they have a subscription service that we pay, I'm going to say, I think $10 to $15 a month. And what it does is it's kind of like a virtual reality buffet, that each month we get to go in and we get to choose five like games or experiences in their library and have unlimited access to it for that month. And then the next month we can either keep those or trade them out for something else that we have access to. That's also led to kind of a shift in our programming that we want to do. As I mentioned, our free plays, our free play events, the attendance was kind of starting to slacken a lot near the end. So we've shifted to a more focused programming now, based around this idea using Viveport subscription model. So this month, we're doing To the Moon and Beyond, where we have like four or five different space-related experiences. And so the idea is that we're doing a couple Saturdays for a few hours that you can come in and try out these space experiences. And then next month, I think we're looking at possibly something with like the human body, being able to explore into sections of the human body or do something there based on in virtual reality. So we're looking at kind of more themed events to kind of get kind of more excitement and kind of give people a wider range of experience than just things like the blue whale experience that we had or some of the deep sea kind of things that we were doing.
That's kind of reminds me of, I believe it's Skokie's, the Boombox, I think that's the name of the program, where they had a, kind of like a maker space, but each month had like a particular theme of what they were working on.
Okay, and I think the Pikes Peak Library District, their makerspace does that something similar. They have like a maker or an artist in residence that they do, and it's each month is different, and they have kind of a different theme that they work on.
Yeah, I think this is a really good tip because, like, we've had a digital media lab, I think, for 5.5 years, and our makerspace for maybe 4 years. And likewise, we've also noticed that just, like, the free open play type thing has gone down. So I'm really glad to hear that there's a next step that libraries can do once that kind of fizzes out. So one thing that when I came to check out your Vive was, so I had seen some videos of it, the art program, which is, was it Tilt Brush?
Tilt Brush, yep.
And Disney animator that was drawing Ariel. So that's what I did when I was there. But at the end of it, I was so excited and happy. I've never drawn in 3D like that before. I didn't know how to take it with me, and I was a little shy about asking the guys. How do y'all handle that?
Actually, it's something that really hasn't come up that much. Usually, because Tilt Brush is a Google program, so in order to save that, you have to be signed into a Google account. So you probably could have like signed into your Google account and saved it there. And then figured out the way to kind of extract it from there. Because those are visible on like a computer screen in like a 3D environment there too.
Yeah. I remember the gentleman that was working, he was kind of like went, nice, good job in the background. And it was really, really impressive. So what kind of tips do you have on like setup, maintenance?
Okay, so setup, you do want to make sure that you have a good amount of space for if you're, especially if you're doing one of the room scale. And the Vive isn't the only room scale one out there. There's the Oculus Rift, which is nice because it only uses a single sensor. But of kind of more interesting note, or not more interesting, but kind of more exciting note at this point now is that as of October, with the new update in Windows 10. Microsoft has introduced the Windows Mixed Reality. They call it Mixed Reality. Right now, it's still all virtual reality. And there is a whole slew of headsets coming out that work natively with Windows 10. You plug the headset in with a single cable into a Windows 10 computer that has the correct updates, and it just works. And so we actually bought two of those headsets as well, too. That we have now. So we have a total of three headsets in the library. So those are really neat with the fact that they don't need sensor units. So we don't have to have our sensor units mounted on the wall for that to work. They actually have sensors in the headset that kind of send out distance sensors and kind of are able to map their own space. I don't really know how it works, but it's really cool. So you want to have a space for people to be able to wander around, because that's one of the things that really kind of gets to it. Most people are used to gaming or doing a computer experience where they're very static, sitting in a chair with a mouse and keyboard. And the fact that you can get them up onto their feet and kind of like walking them around, and that they're like in a simulated room and they could walk over to a table and pick like a cup off the table. It's a really kind of eye-opening experience. Or like you did with Tilt Brush, the idea that you have a 6-foot by 6-foot space that you could walk around in and draw in light and flames and stars all around in that area there in three dimensions opens up people's eyes a lot more than if they're just sitting at a computer and trying to draw in 3D on the computer screen. So space is good. You want to make sure that safety becomes an important thing. One of the kind of the disconcerting things that gets a lot of people when they first try VR is that when you're in that VR headset, the other reality, our reality, disappears. And you aren't aware of where furniture is, where other people are standing. It takes a lot of practice to get used to the cable that's attached to the headset and connected to the computer, so people get tangled up in that a lot. So you want to be able to, first of all, make sure that they're in a safe spot and that they know they can trust walking around, that if they're going to walk into a piece of furniture, that there's somebody there to kind of help guide them away, that other people don't move into their area where they're moving to, where the person in the VR is working.
So it sounds like that this is equipment which a user, especially new users, cannot just be left alone with it. Someone else needs to like have their eyes on them to make sure everything's okay.
I would agree with that. There, it is better, at least for a new person, just to have somebody kind of guide them there. I know, like when I do it alone, I tend to do it in a place that I feel secure in. So, like if I'm doing it at the library, I will actually close and lock the door so that people can't come into the room while I'm there. Because if you're in there, especially if you have headphones on, you really are shut out of what's happening in the real world. At home, again, I actually have one of the library ones that I borrowed with me at home right now when I've tried it here. I also have another – I have a PlayStation VR headset too. So I like VR. I'm really big into this. So I have – and so it's just the idea that once I'm into that there, I need to make sure that the environment around me is secure, because people can creep up on you pretty easily when you're kind of completely oblivious to the world around you. I have a big fear of heights. It's my number one fear. And so I actually do get this kind of real kind of thrill deep in my belly by doing one of these VR simulations and kind of seeing how far out to an edge I can get before I'm absolutely like, nope, 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 and moving away. Because it really, even though if you watch people doing VR, it does look silly. If you're sitting on the outside watching them, the headset looks really silly. They're waving their hands around with these wands, and it looks really kind of silly. And if you look up on – because usually the most setups will have like a screen where you can kind of see an idea of what they're seeing. It doesn't look that impressive when you're outside of it. The graphic fidelity really isn't there that well. So graphic fidelity is how good the graphics look. Mm-hmm. It looks like something that we saw on computers 15, 20 years ago. But when you're in that headset, a lot of that disappears. That graphic fidelity doesn't matter so much. It really is you get this sense of actually being there. And the idea of – because you lose your peripheral vision as well too in a lot of ways. So you turn your head and the world turns around with you. It's all there. It's not just in front of you on your computer screen. It's behind you and above you and below you. So it's that – there's that almost cognitive step that goes from seeing somebody using VR and kind of, okay, this looks kind of silly. I don't really understand how I'm going to get into this here and such. And putting on that headset for the first time is really impressive. It's just that shift that happens that, oh my God, this really is a cool technology that can work. But talking about that first time, it is going back to the idea about kind of like things to be kind of aware of. And if you're planning to do a library program on this year, is pay attention to what kind of experiences you're offering to people, because vertigo and what they call VR sickness is a very real phenomenon that happens now. That because what happens is that if you're in a simulation that there's a lot of moving around, like if you're the idea of like riding on a roller coaster virtually, your mind and your eyes are telling you that you're moving along this roller coaster ride, but your inner ear is telling you that, hey, you're standing still. And that's what gives you that sense of vertigo. That's the same thing that gives you motion sickness in a car. So I found certain simulations. There's the tilt brush one that you did. There's a Deep Blue Sea one, in which case the person who's working in it, they are standing still, or in the case of tilt brush, any movement that happens, they're the ones that are actually moving and causing that movement to happen. So people who have had virtual reality sickness or have an issue with motion sickness, they might be better in a system where they either are standing still and things are kind of revolving around them a bit, or something where they're the ones activating the movement. So it's be aware of the experiences that you're offering to people. It is useful to talk to the people a little bit before you put the headset on. And I find it's convenient to kind of talk them through. I'm putting the headset on and we're going to tighten it here, kind of go through the steps of what they're doing. Okay, now if you put out your hands, I'm going to put the controllers in your hand. Here's the right one. Here's the left one. And then even while they're in it, being able to make sure that things like volume isn't too loud so that you can kind of talk to them and kind of make sure that they're hearing instructions. Mm-hmm. So if they are about to walk into something, you can tell them to stop. Or if it's like something, it's like, okay, you're getting twisted around the cable, stop, turn around to your left a little bit. So if you're going to be doing things in the library program, as you said, it's probably not good to leave it unsupervised unless you have really experienced people using it. For most of the public coming in that this is their first time or second time trying VR, you do want to kind of make sure it's a supervised experience. Mm-hmm. Simply because they're going to be disoriented in there, and they're not going to be aware of what's going on around them. And other people are really excited about it too, and they might press in and kind of close in on the space.
Speaking of that, have y'all had any experiences with the equipment getting damaged?
Actually, no. People tend to be really, really kind of careful and almost gingerly with the equipment. So it's they know that it's expensive, and surprisingly, I mean, this stuff is actually pretty hardy. I mean, you're waving around wands. If anybody remembers when the Nintendo Wii came out, and you had the Wiimote that people were swinging around, if they didn't put the wrist thing on, they would throw out of their hands, and people's like $5,000 plasma TVs were being broken. So, I mean, you're waving this thing around. You do smack things around. I mean, it happens. No matter how well you can supervise people, they're going to go and they're going to smack the one thing that you thought was out of their way. we actually have not had any problem with any kind of equipment breaking. The most issues that we've had with anything is actually the computers. Either it doesn't read the connection properly, or Windows 10 decides it wants to do an update, and we sit there for 45 minutes waiting for it to finish its update, and we start the program an hour late.
I understand the pain of that. I've seen somewhere where someone had asked, is this something that you could put on a cart and, like, take out into the community?
And the Vive, initially, or the Vive, I would say no, because it needs to have these, it needs to have the base stations in. But in ways you can, if you have tripods or mounts for them, they have a standard quarter inch like hole, which is the standard for a like a photography tripod hole on there for mounting. So if you got a couple tripods, you can take them out and you can set them up almost anywhere. You do have to worry about light, because they actually use light signals, so you don't want to have like direct sunlight or something. But you mm-hmm. could pack up everything. Since we have a laptop, it's made it a lot easier. We can just pack that up with all these stuff, and we've gone up to our branch and done a setup at our branch there. The new Windows Mixed Reality headsets, because they don't use the sensor stations, they're a lot more portable and flexible in that regards. And I keep telling our Makerspace librarian that what we need to do is we need to buy a laptop backpack. So what happens is you get the laptop and you set it up so that when it's closed, it still runs. Mm-hmm. And so what you do is you have the headset plugged in there, put the backpack onto the person, and now they no longer have a tether tying them to a fixed place where the computer is sitting. They can actually walk around their designated space more free. I mean, they have a backpack on their back, but that's easily – that kind of disappears while you're into the experience there. So yes, they're – with the systems that are coming up, HTC just announced last week at CES the HTC Vive Pro, which is their next generation. So if you're looking at buying a headset now, wait a few more months, because there's some really exciting things kind of coming down the road in 2018. The Vive Pro is actually coming with a wireless module on there, so you no longer have the tethered cable to the computer. It's also going to have higher resolution, and the higher resolution that you get in the headset, the better the experience is going to be.
Do you know offhand how much the cost for the Windows Mixed Media headset?
So they range. They start at about $300, which is, I mean, that's an incredibly low end for the generation of technology that we're at to get into it. And that's with like one of the Acer, by a company called Acer.
Yes.
I've used that headset. It's this blue plasticky looking thing. It's incredibly light, so it actually feels really comfortable, and it was a really good experience. At the higher end of that market is you have the Samsung Odyssey. The Samsung Odyssey is the kind of the higher end, and they're about $600. And they have – you can definitely tell kind of construction style between the two headsets that the Samsung Odyssey is kind of a little bit better constructed. It has a higher resolution, has one of the highest resolutions out of the VR headsets that are out there right now. In addition, it has a wider field of view. And so the field of view, when a human normally has something about close to about 180 degree field of view, which means that 180 with your peripheral vision, you can kind of see right to the direct left and right of your head. And Amanda can see this, but the people listening here can't see me waving my hands on either side of my head right now. The most headsets have somewhere around 100 degree field of view. So you can see you're losing about 80 degrees kind of out of your peripheral vision there.
The
Odyssey, I think, has around 120, which is one of the highest out there on the markets right now. So you're getting to see a lot more around. And that comes from things like the shape of the lens that they're using and the resolution that they're giving you on there. And so that's about 600. We have two of those at the Ferguson Library. And so I've tried them out. And they are really good. The headset is not as comfortable as some of the other ones. But once you have it on and using it, it really is a kind of a markup in experience.
Any complaints about or how to deal with people who wear glasses when they put on these headsets?
Okay, so glasses is a interesting thing. And so I was talking about the The Samsung Odyssey. If you read through the instructions on the Samsung Odyssey, they specifically say don't wear glasses with them because you'll scratch the lenses. Most of the other headsets, the Vive, the Acer that I used, the PlayStation VR, they're all designs that they're actually set up with a good enough distance from your face that people wearing glasses have no problem with it. If you have a patron who's wanting to try it out and they are wearing glasses, definitely help them put on the headset. And usually what you do is you put the headset over their face and then bring the straps in over the head. So it is there. People wearing glasses, if you want to kind of make it open to that there and such, kind of go out there and read the reviews of the headsets and see what people are talking about that there. I know the Samsung one specifically really doesn't, but a lot of the others, the Vive definitely can work with glasses. And I've done that a lot and helped patrons with that a lot. If the glasses are too big, it might be of an issue, but I haven't had a problem with that yet.
Is there anything you'd want the VR systems to do differently for a library audience?
Oh, that's a good question. Trying to think. I mean, I like what they're doing so far. I think the one thing I would probably want is not so much on the VR headset side, but actually on the content creation, is I would like to see an easier to use tool for creating 3D environments. So the idea of not just having the headset for people to experience, but having people being able to create their own experiences and create their own worlds to explore. And so the tools that are out there, things like the Unity and Unreal, they do have a steep learning curve on them. So I would like something simpler for them to use to be able to create those experiences that we can kind of teach library users to kind of build their own virtual worlds that they can then explore in VR.
All right. Well, thank you so very much, Frank. I really enjoyed talking to you. And that is all for Circulating Ideas this week. Bye.
Bye.
Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta with support from listeners like you. Find out how you can help by going to circulatingideas.com and clicking on support. You can also subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice. And help others find the show by leaving a rating or review. You can follow the show on Twitter @CircIdeas or like the show's Facebook page. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thanks for listening and keep circulating your ideas.
Yeah, feel free to edit that however you want.
For once, I don't have to edit this. Steve was just like, send it to me and I'll deal with it.